The Evil Dead movies are cult classics.
Name's Ash. Housewares.
But as Bruce Campbell could tell you, starring in a cult classic doesn't mean you've made it in Hollywood. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Bruce Campbell has been a chainsaw-wielding zombie killer, a cowboy, an aging Elvis impersonator with cancer, a former Navy SEAL, the King of Thieves, Santa Claus, and many characters in between. He's also a heck of a storyteller. This hour, I'll talk with Bruce Campbell about the stories he shares in his latest memoir, Hail to the Chin, Further Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Actor, director, producer, and writer Bruce Campbell may have been seen by the most people in his cameo roles in all three of Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man movies. He's well known and beloved for playing the role of Sam Axe on Burn Notice on the USA Network. But the role he's best known for, the role that just won't die, is Ash Williams, houseware clerk at S-Mart and zombie fighter, the protagonist of the Evil Dead franchise. A role he first played in 1981 and is still playing in the series Ash vs. the Evil Dead on the Starz Network. He has just published his second memoir, Hail to the Chin, Further Confessions of a B-Movie Actor, and he's in Iowa City today, here with me, Bruce Campbell. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I was lining up a shot last season during Ash vs. Evil Dead with Ted Raimi, who was playing a character, Henrietta, a possessed, horrible hag. And we looked at each other, and I'm playing Ash, and he's playing Henrietta, and this was 30 years after Evil Dead 2 already. I said, Ted, you know, our careers, they're really taking off. We are really going somewhere. He's like, yeah, his head just hung down a little bit. I'm like, well, you know, you got to have something on your tombstone, so sure, let's do it. You want Ash? Now people are going to choke on him. Let's go. How much can you take?
Well, of course, your diehard fans know a little bit about your childhood and how you got started in movie making. But it's really a story that somebody should make a movie about. And for people who don't know about it, can you take us back to your childhood in Michigan and when you started messing around with Super 8 films?
It was all about neighborhoods. My neighborhood, I had a guy named Mike Ditz who had a 16-millimeter camera. You would expose 25 feet of it, flip the cartridge out, expose another 25 feet, then they would cut it in half at the lab and send you back your regular 8-millimeter film. Another neighborhood, Scott Spiegel, who wound up co-writing one of the Evil Dead movies, had a very elaborate setup. He had a projection room in one of the basements of his buddy's house. They built sets. They would intercut stock footage that he bought from little movies. So those guys were way ahead of the curve. Sam Raimi was a magician in his little neighborhood, but his father had a camera, so he would do his little movies. And then starting junior high school and high school, we started to collide with each other and show these movies. And it was a very quick mutual interest. So that's what we did on weekends. We didn't really party. We didn't get in hardly any trouble. We worked at a supermarket. And if any pies or cakes or anything went bad, we'd go, well, just give them to us. And then we'll do a pie fight over the weekend with whatever was available, old macaroni, old potato salad. So it was a great source for stuff that was not quite bad, but they couldn't sell it anymore. that was kind of how it started. And then high school was going to end, and we were mortified. We were like, well, we hadn't really planned on what we're going to do. Could we actually do this? Could we actually continue this? So we thought, probably not. Sam went off to Michigan State. I went to Western Michigan for 6 months. And we met another guy, Rob Tappert. And so Rob was the first guy to go, look, if you want to raise money, you got to get a lawyer involved. You got to actually kind of do this for real. So that's what eventually led to the world of Evil Dead.
And let's talk about the Evil Dead, because after you were making films and you were getting them in front of audiences, there was sort of this aha moment where you realized the thing you were best at was scaring people.
But that was weird. That was a weird progression because normally we would do very silly movies, all of them, all very Three Stooges based. Sam was very Marx Brothers. Another guy, Josh Becker, was really into the Woody Allen type humor. But then we did Sam did a movie called It's Murder, which was like a weird, dumb murder mystery, big epic, like $2,000 this thing cost. It was,
whoa.
It bankrupted. It changed everything. But there was a moment in it where a guy's in a car and he's waiting and he's looking around and from behind the bad guy reaches out and grabs him. And every time they had a showing, the audience, they would literally jump out of their seat. And Sam was like, So when we got to thinking more seriously about making a feature film, we thought, well, a comedy, if you did a comedy like we're doing, you'd have to have like a Steve Martin or a John Candy or whoever, with Bill Murray type guy. We're like, we're not going to find them. It just seemed impossible. But a horror movie you could make with absolute nobodies. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, starring nobody. The original Halloween, nobody. It was Jamie Lee Curtis, but she was a nobody. Everybody, Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, all nobodies. And you could get away with having normal cars and clothes. You didn't have to be look like Dynasty or anything fancy. And you could just, that was a way to make a cheap movie that you could sell. Because we went to the drive-ins, and the last of these weird drive-ins in the late 70s, and we would watch the audience reaction. And mostly is, if you made a horror movie and you slacked off and it got boring, they would turn their lights on and honk their horns. Like Revenge of the Cheerleaders was playing. And it hit a really...
The instant review.
Yeah, a bad, bad spot. And the lights would all come on, and they would flash the brights on and off until it got better, and then the lights would go off and they'd stop honking. And we were like, oh my God, what a lesson. So we watched Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is my favorite of the originals. It's such a disturbing movie on so many levels. But when that horror started in the movie, it never stopped. And so to us, we went, okay, A, let's make a horror movie. Let's try and make a horror movie. But if we do it, no holds barred. No, everything's over the top.
Well, and the first of the Evil Dead movies that I saw was actually Army of Darkness, which is hilarious.
That's a good way to start. And then you can go backwards and stop whenever it gets too horrible.
I was surprised. Then I went back and watched the first one. I'm like, oh, that's kind of a straight up horror movie.
It is. It's sort of a failed melodrama, really. It was serious dialogue that was lousy, delivered by inexperienced actors. So equals unintended laughter. And a lot of the gore was so over the top that got elicited sometimes a little bit of laughter because you're like, is that pencil really going right into her Achilles tendon? And now, okay, it's still in there. Yep. You know, we're using Apple sound effects, and it was...
It was really your first taste of success.
Yeah, because we didn't know... It turns out, in hindsight, it was probably the first and last handmade movie I've ever worked on, where it was our coming attraction that we edited. It was our poster that we designed, took the picture, and we had to go learn about screen lines and Veloxes and the actual real dimensions of a page in Variety, like what are the actual dimensions, going to printers and really doing stuff that has nothing to do with movies. But it was all critical. And along the way, we had what I would say two or three key things that happened. One was meeting Irvin Shapiro. Irvin Shapiro was, when we met him, mid-'80s, early 80s. You know, this guy worked on publicity for the battleship Potemkin by Sergei Eisenstein, you know, a silent movie. He was instrumental in bringing, he's one of the founding fathers of the Cannes Film Festival, of bringing movies overseas and selling them. And so he handled George Romero's early movie, Martin, I think it was called. But so we thought, okay, this guy, if he repped him, then he would understand. If we show him this movie, he'll get that. And so we screened it for him, and he goes, well, it's not exactly Gone with the Wind, but I think we can make some money with it. And he goes, you're going to have to change the title. It was called Book of the Dead. And we're like, we thought it was a good title. He goes, no, people are going to think they got to read for 90 minutes. No, new title. So we auditioned a bunch of titles, came up with a really stupid 101% Dead, you know, every dumb title you can imagine. And finally he goes, you should call it Evil Dead. We went, Evil Dead, just that's Evil Dead. Yeah. I thought it was the dumbest title I'd ever heard. But now it's just, you know, okay, Evil Dead. That's fine. So that guy helped instrumentally. Stephen King also saw it in probably 82 or something. And that's when Stephen King was, you know, Stephen King. He was the master of all that was horrible. And he saw it at the Cannes Film Festival and called it the most ferociously original horror film of the year. And this really changed the game because a lot of reviewers then saw it with new eyes, if you will. Because before that, the reviews were very dodgy. An Atlanta paper called it the sickest of the sick. Every bad idea Sam Raimi's ever had, he put into a low-budget blender. I'm like, wow, what a nasty review. Another one, the headline was Films That Stoop. Like, you're not attending to do anything. But so then after that, after the Stephen King endorsement, we begged him to use that quote. And he was so gracious to say yes. So, of course, that's right on the poster, you know. The next review we got was from the L.A. Times. Kevin Thomas called it an instant classic. So I know that it's not an instant classic. And I know that it's not the sickest of the sick. It's somewhere in between. But, you know, that it did change the radar of the movie. It was banned in Europe, though, for quite a while. There was a court case. Then they won the court case. It was called a video nasty, and it was banned. In the UK, you can just straight up ban. You ban it, which was surprising to us, because here in the States, you can't really ban something.
Right.
So we won the court case. Now everybody in the world wanted to know what was this video nasty that I was not supposed to see.
Right.
Goes to number one in the video charts of 1983. And we beat The Shining. The Shining's like number seven. We're like, yeah, Stan.
So you have this success with Evil Dead. And it becomes this cult classic.
Slow. It's like a rash, you know. It's very slow moving. None of this is like those big opening weekends.
So really, your lifetime defining role.
Yeah.
But it didn't.
Now I'm chipping that into my tombstone right now.
Exactly, give you instant stardom or all kinds of Hollywood access.
No, we were fortunate enough to do a second movie, which was called Crime Wave, that the Coen brothers wrote. Joel and Ethan, because Joel Coen was the assistant editor of the first Evil Dead. And so he goes, hey, I got this script called Blood Simple. We're like, yeah, whatever. So we helped him make that, and so they got going. But we had to do another movie, and we got Norman Lear's company interested in doing this film, but ultimately it was called Crime Wave. And there is no other version of Evil Dead. There is no other director's cut. There was only one cut, and it was ours. There's never been. So we've had creative control from the very beginning, and Crime Wave was welcome to Hollywood.
We'll talk about true Hollywood in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. My guest today is Bruce Campbell. He is many things, but most recently, the author of his second memoir. It's called Hail to the Chin, Further Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. He'll be up in front of a sold-out crowd at the Englert Theater in Iowa City tonight. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, my guest is Bruce Campbell. He's just published his second memoir. It's called Hail to the Chin, Further Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. You may know him from the Evil Dead movies or from the USA series Burn Notice that ran for 7 seasons. Probably you're familiar with his face, even if you don't know that you know who Bruce Campbell is, because you've seen him around, and he is one of the biggest cult heroes of film in the United States, around the world, in fact, right now. People travel many, many miles to get a chance to meet Bruce Campbell. And Bruce, as you were rising in the
Is that
panels,
the word you're
right?
going to use?
I'll try that.
Yeah, good.
You did a lot of B films, and obviously your first book tells the story of a lot of those. And you thought that maybe when you got the series Briscoe County Jr., maybe that was going to be the big break.
That was my ticket.
Right. And that lasted, what, a season? Right?
Yeah, one season. I had 2 one-season wonders, that and another short-lived one, Jack of All Trades. Jack of One Season, that's what I call it.
But you did a lot of really fascinating stuff. You worked on Hercules and Xena.
Yeah, down in New Zealand, Ash vs. Evil Dead, that's my fourth TV show down there because I started on Hercules, directing Hercules. Then I got in it, and then I was directing Xena's, and I got in Xena's, and then the Jack of All Trades, and now Ash vs. Evil Dead. So there are crew members down there that I've known for 20 years.
Wow. Was there kind of a moment as you were developing your career and getting these different roles and working on these different projects? I mean, I'm struck by your flexibility at sort of jumping into different things. But was there ever a moment where you thought, you know what, this is it. This is where I am. I'm going to explore this world of B-movies and TV series that people aren't ever going to take seriously but will love, that this is my thing.
Well, it's weird. New Zealand and Hercules and Xena were the first taste of that because we were so far away from a studio. It was for syndication, so there wasn't really a studio. And it would take 4 days for the footage to get back to somebody in Los Angeles and see it. So we could pull that stuff of, like, if they didn't like something, we'd go, oh, we're on to the next episode.
We've already torn down that set.
Yeah. we're past that. Yeah, sorry. We had so little intervention, and my manager at the time was like, why do you keep going to New Zealand? What, nobody watches that show. First of all, he's full of crap. It was the number one syndicated show, Hercules.
Right.
And then Xena really became iconic beyond that. But, you know, we had days of shooting where we didn't use a single word that was in the script because we just didn't think like that was as good as what we felt like we wanted to do. So the creatively, it was off the hook.
And that sounds really great.
It is. It's the only I would get fired off any Aaron Sorkin show because he'd go, Bruce, you changed a comma in scene 7. Did I? You're fired. There's a lot of writing, especially in television, that can get very protective of itself. And my feeling is if you have the Paddy Chayefsky clause, which is actors don't change my dialogue, the guy who wrote Marty. Okay, if you're that good, maybe. How many guys are that good? Especially on the spur of the moment. Things happen, props break, you know, gags don't work like you thought they would. I want the ability to try and fix it, you know. And so creatively, I couldn't top that. And going back now to Ash versus Evil Dead, it's the same thing. I'm the last arbiter of what comes out of Ash's mouth or what doesn't. And that's a fun process. And I've warned the writers point blank, guys, you bring it or don't be surprised at what you see in the dailies, because I feel that it's our responsibility to put, you know, they write it. We got to put it on the road. We have to launch that ship. And sometimes you go, dude, this doesn't work.
Now, being this cult hero and being, I don't know, you've always been very generous with your fans. You continue to be very generous with your fans. But it strikes me that people feel like you are very, very approachable. People must just have brought you projects all the time. Was that almost a difficult thing that people are like, oh, hey, you should be in this indie film that I'm going to make for $12. You'd be perfect.
No, where I live now, it's actually very refreshing. I was waiting for my luggage to come down our single, luggage carrier. I'm standing there, and a guy just comes up and just slaps his hand on my shoulder and goes, what was the name of that movie you were in, man? Like I was the neighbor, you know? So there's some guys who are like that. There's no bubble. They're right there because they figure they know you. And there's a lot of that familiarity. The ones that I'm not as cool about are the two people who meet you at the airport with stuff to sign. Mm. And you go, now, okay, now let's think this through for a second. Who knew I was on that flight? Did somebody tweet it to them? Hey, Bruce Campbell's on this flight. That's the weird thing. And they'll never tell you. Miami, it happened to me all the time. And I'm like, dude, who do you know at American Airlines? And that's not as fun.
Yeah.
That starts to get into creepy town.
Yeah.
And I, and these are guys who honestly just don't want to get into the convention. You can see me at 30 cities across this country from now until November. It's like, it's not impossible. And we can get a great photo because you get a photo op and they have these really good photographers and you bring props and we do all kinds of gags. That's the place and the time to do it. You're going to get the actor in their happy spot. Everyone's going to look good. And that's the way to do it. Sometimes if you catch them out of that zone, some actors are like, uh-uh.
Yeah.
They'll shut them down.
I want to talk about an unusual film that you did, Bubba Ho-Tep, which I don't know if I can even summarize the plot very well, but you played an aging Elvis impersonator who believed he was Elvis, right?
No, this was Elvis.
Oh, it was Elvis.
Yeah, but he swapped. The person who died was the Elvis impersonator. He liked the drugs, and he's the one who died. Elvis just wanted to get out. So basically, 68-year-old Elvis is in an East Texas rest home. He's dying. He has cancer on his penis. And he meets a guy who thinks he's JFK, played by the great Ossie Davis, who is an African-American. And he says that they've got his brain hooked up to batteries back to the White House. Oh, yeah. And there's a mummy sneaking into the rest home to suck the souls out of the old people through various orify.
All right. So Elvis decides that he's going to be the hero here. We have
a real hero.
Yes. We have a little clip from Bubba Ho-Tep where Elvis decides he's going to take action and protect everybody from the mummy. And he calls
Mr.
Jack,
President.
Right?
That's right. Mr. President.
In the movies, I always played heroic types. But when the stage lights went out, it was time for drugs and stupidity and the coveting of women. Now it's time. Time to be a little of what I'd always fantasized being, a hero.
Hello.
Mr. Kennedy, ask not what your rest home can do for you. Ask what you can do for your rest home.
Hey. You're copying my best lines.
And let me paraphrase one of my own. Let's take care of business.
Just what are you getting at, Elvis?
I think you know what I'm getting at, Mr. President. We're going to kill us a mummy.
So that's just a moment from Bubba Ho-Tep. And it strikes me, I mean, you get an idea like that, and it's either genius or awful. How do you know?
That one could go either way. Well, for me, it was Don Coscarelli, I knew, had a great affinity with his background because he did the Phantasm movies, also very handmade, late 70s. We have a very similar backgrounds in movie making, so I knew he was very competent. But I said, Don, it's a simple question. Are you going to see it? He goes, see what? I go, are you going to see the penis? Because it's a crazy over-the-top story, and I need to know if you're going into Pink Flamingos land or not. Because if you are, you can't get that back. He goes, no, it's only implied. You never see it. I go, okay, second question. How long is the shoot? Because a lot of these low-budget movies, they go 2 weeks. And you know that if you don't have a really experienced person at the head of that, it's going to be a disaster. Don goes, 6 weeks. I went, okay, then we're good. Because I knew that he was not going to race through this. You know, it was the weirdest script I ever read in my life.
Yeah.
But at the core of it, there is a lovely theme which got me, and it works in the movie, is what do you do with old people, even really famous old people? People forget about everybody. And are they still useful? Is there still a place for them, you know? And that's what I picked up. And Ossie Davis, I looked at him, you know, first day of shooting, I'm like, Ossie, I know why I'm in this movie. Why are you in this movie? He said it was his grandkids. They said he should do it because they knew the Evil Dead movies.
Really?
Yeah, so he gave us so much street cred.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, this might actually be like a legitimate movie.
Well, now, speaking of legitimate movies, you just laid out a couple of criteria for legitimacy, but then you kind of broke all of the rules with a movie called My Name is Bruce, in which you play yourself, but the character of yourself.
Right. A meta movie.
And this, you're kidnapped, right?
Kidnapped by a kid who thinks that Bruce Campbell actually will help save his town from a monster that's getting revenge.
Right.
It's a mine shaft that was guarded by Guan Di, the Chinese god of war, because he's the protector of the dead. And a bunch of Chinese miners in my area, this is all kind of, it's real enough. The Chinese mined everything where I'm from in Southern Oregon. And so the god of war is protecting them and some kids screwing around in the graveyard being those wacky horror kids. They unleash this demon. So the kid thinks that Bruce Campbell will actually help save the town when he doesn't realize that the real Bruce Campbell is a jerk and a butt wipe and a drunk and, you know, and a loser non-participant. And so he has to, he thinks it's all a big practical joke from his agent until he sees someone get decapitated. And he's like, wait, you mean this crap is real? So he has to learn how to kind of go from being a loser movie hero to a hero. And it's a horrid, rocky journey.
And we're going to talk about the rocky journey it took to get the film made as well. But first, we'll listen to just a short clip from My Name is Bruce when Bruce Campbell, the character in the film, is presented with a custom-built chainsaw, which, of course, he would have used in The Evil Dead.
I've gotten a lot of use out of chainsaws over the years. Killed a lot of zombies. Saved a lot of lives. But at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, they're just too damn heavy. So thanks just the same, kid.
You know, it had to be said. It had to be said.
You broke all of your own personal rules on getting this film made. This is a film you really wanted to do. And you ended up building the set, of making your own backlot, building a town on your own property, right?
Yeah, yeah. My darling wife of 26 years, I basically put her in the hospital. So filmmakers, don't put your wives in the hospital. It's not worth it. Because I had a big scheduling thing. I had to go on a tour that started at a certain time. So this town had to be built by a certain time. But the movie wasn't really put together yet, financed yet. So, yeah, you're not supposed to build anything on your own property. This never.
And you're not supposed to invest a whole bunch of your own money.
Your own money before everything's ready. No, don't do it. But it was actually really fun in a ma-and-pa kettle way to find a local couple of rancher types who had the most ridiculous stuff on their property. And we bought old cars and lumber and built a back lot. That was the funnest part.
So you built this back lot. I mean, you had to build a town that looked like a town. What did you do with it after?
Well, I thought it would be so clever. Oh, I was just the most clever fella. I called the police department. The fire department. I said, you know, I got a great, you guys could come out here and learn a lot. You could burn this thing down and the guys will learn all about it.
Sure.
All about it. Because the neighbor goes, just have them burn it down. That's all you have to do. Well, the guy gets out of his car. He walks two steps, looks at it, goes around behind, comes back out the front. He goes, yeah, nice try. I go, what do you mean, nice try? He goes, there's no real walls. There's no real insulation. Nothing is sealed. My guys, they hold like a temperature meter. They're not going to get anything because it's all pouring out the back. He goes, you just wanted us to come and burn this down for you, didn't you? I'm like, well, thanks for coming out anyway. Smartest thing I did was I made sure they bolted it together. There were going to be no permanent anything and no concrete. So we pulled the post up and unbolted the doggone thing.
So you had to hire a contractor to come out and do that.
Right? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, man, I'll tell you, now I know why you have building codes. Because the guy who built it, as he was leaving, goes, you might want to put a coat of paint on the back of it. We're like, why? It's just wood. Oh, yeah, you'll see. If you wood exposed to water, it's amazing what that wood did after a while. Doors were folding on themselves. It was really... Now I see. Now I see why there are rules.
Do you have any of it left?
Yeah, I do. I'm storing like lawnmowers underneath it. It's all rickety and drippy. I'm waiting to tear that thing down. I finally built a proper garage, so now I can take that down. Well, it's very funny. When it was all up, like a new UPS guy came up, and it was we had this sign that said Goldlick.
Yeah.
And he pulls up. He goes, what is this, like a ghost town or something? We're like, no. No, it's fake. It's fake. Why'd you build something like that on your property? Like, just give me the package. Well, it's just too long. And dealing with the county was funny too. They spit the coffee of like, you want to do what? And we're trying to tell them how, you know, it's fake. It's fake. Well, I'm man, but the permit process. We're like, no. We can't do the permit process. We're not really permitting. No one's gonna live here. So it was a weird experience, but still fun because it was. Making movies by hand. I put an ad in the local paper.
Yeah, it was a lot like what you were doing when you were a kid.
Oh, absolutely. We put an ad in, got wood. And we said, we'll remove your wood in trade. We had to phrase it so that no money. I'll just come, whatever you got, I'll haul your crap away. We got so much wood. It was 2 24-foot trucks full of wood. Granted, a lot of it was really crappy, and we did a lot of people favors. But
And you pulled in a lot of local actors, too, right?
All local. Every single one. A kid who's in the local play, he's like, he was so shocked. He goes, wait, I'm getting paid to act? I went, yeah, not much, but yeah, paid. He went, wait, I'm getting paid to act? he couldn't compute that. But we have the local Shakespeare Festival in Ashland, Oregon. These are really talented people. So I got a guy who built animal masks, and he performed them at parties. So I went, hey, we need a monster to play this Chinese God of War. How about if, A, you build it for yourself, and B, you perform it? He goes, perfect. So then I'm like, you can't complain about your costume. If your mask sucks, it's not my fault, man. So he was great. He was the perfect guy to hire, and it was local, and he'll never do anything like that ever again.
And you also, it sounds like you let anybody who wanted to be in the movie be in the movie.
Well, yeah, if they didn't get a big part, they could just be in the background.
Nice. So everybody who tried, they got to be
extras.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Very cool. All right, we're going to take a short break. We've been talking now about the movie My Name is Bruce. I'm talking with actor, director, writer, producer Bruce Campbell. Of course, beloved for the Evil Dead series. He's also starring in Ash vs. the Evil Dead on the Starz Network these days. He's just released his second memoir. It's called Hail to the Chin, Further Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. He's going to be in Iowa City tonight, a sold-out crowd at the Englert Theater. And you're welcome to join our conversation if you want to give us a call. 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, my guest is actor, director, producer, writer Bruce Campbell. His latest book is his second memoir, Hail to the Chin, Further Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. And you are welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I'm not sure B-movie actor is necessarily the best description for you anymore. Burn Notice was on for seven seasons.
That was a B television show. Crap blew up all the time. Gunshots, cars skidding, you know, hot ladies walking around in skimpy bikinis. That's a total B show, B television.
And you didn't even do the pilot. Well, at least that's what you wrote, because you didn't want to go to Miami.
Oh, I didn't. Yeah, I did. I was not about to return to that city because I had had three dismal failures in a row between book signings and movie screenings. I was like, okay, people in Miami, you can all just shove it because obviously I'm not for you. So see ya. I'll never see you again. And like a month later, there's a new pilot for a show in Miami. I'm like, wow. That's how the universe works. It's so perfect. And, of course, it's not just the pilot. It's the longest I've ever worked anywhere.
Right. Well, and that's the other thing. You've done a lot of pilots, so you didn't think that was going to go
anywhere?
No, it
was just another pilot. I was very confident, though, once we started shooting. It felt right. It looked cool. The chemistry with the actors was there. And sometimes, you know, you fail the chemistry test, there's nothing you can do. So the elements seemed right. And USA was the right network. They had this blue sky show theory that they wanted – nice outdoor location. Like, we had to be outdoors if an episode was 7 days, 4 or 5 days.
Wow.
Outdoors, running around, real locations everywhere. But
and real explosions. That was really important.
Yeah, the Matt Nix, who created the show, had an edict. It just came down hot and hard from the beginning, non-negotiable, no digital anything. Because he described the weird things that smoke and fire will do after an explosion. He goes, digital guys will never do that. It's too weird. Fire has its own life, kind of. And he's right. But we got sick of it after a while. We're like, hey, where's the stunt guy? Just can you please blow it up behind him? You know, because it's really unsettling. We had to run away. It's in the opening credits. Me and Jeffrey Donovan are running away from this boat, and they blow the living crap out of that boat. You feel the concussion. You feel the warmth. And, you know, you never really know. You're running away from the thing that's rigged. It's rigged to blow up when you're inside of it. That's the creepiest part. Oh. They go, okay, go hot. They're shouting. You hear a series of, go hot, we're hot. It means, like, that sucker could, the guys, it could blow, and you're inside the building or whatever it is. So That to me is the worst moment, is from that time to the time they say action.
Wow.
Because you go, what if a guy, you know, hiccups and hits right. the wham?
Oh, man.
So, you know, it got old, but it sure looks great. It really does. We blew one off. Air Force One flew right over the top of us as we blew off this gigantic explosion. This mushroom cloud is going up. We're like, oh, my God. Obama's guys, they're diving on top of him right now. Like, it's coming, it's coming.
Oh,
the timing
gosh.
Of it, we couldn't have faked it any better. Ridiculous. Yeah, we blew up half of Miami.
And not all, it sounds like people in Miami weren't always expecting it either. Neighbors.
No, I was convinced that I was going to get shot in Miami. We had a scene, I got a high-powered rifle with a scope on it, four floors up on a building on like an exoskeleton of the building, and I'm firing down below, and these are full loads. These fake rounds have different waddings. This was known as a full load. It's basically echoing like through the canyons of downtown Miami about 11 in the morning, and you look up there, and there's no film crew. They're all down below shooting up. Normally, you could look up and see a guy with a microphone pole. You'd see lights, and you go, oh, they're making a movie.
Right.
No, there's
nothing. No, it's just a sniper
just
on the roof.
Just some crazy guy firing away.
Which is not that far from reality.
Oh, no. I thought some guy would go, you know, some guy off duty, you know, bah, bah. I figured that's how I'd get it. But we worked very closely with the cops down there. My favorite guy was Taser Tom, we called him.
Not his official name.
Well, no, I call him, T-Squared is what we call him. Because we'd play the Taser games of, like, what would get him to Taser me. I would just torment him with certain scenarios. He wanted to tase me bad. He really,
and he offered to, right?
Oh, multiple times, yeah. Bruce,
just
you should
see.
Really feel like it. I'm like, no, Tom. No, I really shouldn't.
Had he tasered himself to check it out?
I'm sure he had some training. But he actually really enjoyed tasing guys.
Okay. Moving on. I want to read you a couple emails that have come in. This one's from Hans. He says, Bruce Campbell is so much fun. I cannot be the only person that loved the quirky mix of science fiction and Old West and the adventures of Briscoe County Jr. I really, really wanted more of that story. I also like Evil Dead and Army of Darkness. Horror is best when it's mixed with comedy, and Bruce is the absolute best. Sam Raimi isn't bad either. Thanks for those and many other fun performances, and I could go on. This one's from Jenny. My name is Jennifer, and I'm going to be seeing Bruce Campbell tonight in Iowa City. I'm so excited. I've always been such a huge fan. I can't wait. I want him to sign my copy of Evil Dead DVD. This is a dream come true. This is kind of a small sample of the kind of people that you see when you travel around to conventions. And the convention circuit has gotten so big. And in fact, I mean, really, the way that our culture has morphed, the genre that you've been involved with, you get a lot more respect these days than you did when you were starting out.
I just feel vindicated. Because I've always gone, look, stop making fun of B-movies. You know, you can have really crazy stories, wild characters, great villains, fantastic twist endings. You know, you can time travel, all that stuff. It really frees you up, is my feeling. And now, what are the A-movies? Guy who dresses up like a bat and flies around. Guess what, folks? That is so much of a B movie. Spider-Man.
Well, you really think
Spider-Man.
But you really think that Spider-Man, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, was that kind of where things really started to shift?
It didn't hurt. It didn't hurt. I think because that had a really huge opening. And I think it showed them that the world of comics and fantasy, it's not dead. Because they keep Superman, they keep throwing up against the wall. Batman, they keep throwing that up against the wall, hoping it'll stick a little more. It's, you know, with the Spider-Mans, it's like they never made the first three. They already got the next three lined up with some other schmo who's going to put the mask on. It doesn't matter. It's the franchise. But so it kind of shows you that, a lot of the studios are run by nerds, just flat-out nerds. Now they go, yeah, well, let's do that comic book movie. That's where you are. And all the viewers are young. The executives are young. They're going to – the fantasy, and I think – where we are as a society, we want heroes badly, and we want to see the good guy win. You know, and that's what heroes are for.
Well, and it's become a lot more acceptable and mainstream to be the geeky fan, too. I mean, that's the geek chic. That's cool
these,
now.
At these conventions, somebody explained to me very succinctly. They said, when I go there, I have 1,000 friends instantly, and nobody's going to make fun of me. And let me tell you, there's some hooking up going on at these places. Oh, you like Silver Surfer? So do I. I'm Darth Vader. Let's go do something. You know, they feel a kinship, and boy, the cosplay has really kicked up. The costume contest now. The old days used to be pretty funny. You know, guys with cardboard boxes on their head painted funny colors. Now, oh my God, the elaborate. They do electrical stuff and the prosthetics and
right. Well, the costumes are better than the costumes that were actually in the movies, probably a lot of the time.
It's very impressive what these people do.
So, what do Evil Dead fans wear?
There have been women dressing as Ash, and they're torn their clothes, sort of like how Ash is torn. But for some reason, they have short shorts now. Torn short shorts. It's like all the young women walking to school the other day. I mean, everyone had the torn shorts. Every single had torn jeans, covered with blood with a chainsaw, and they are oddly beguiling. is what I would say.
So this convention circuit. I mean, a lot of actors and other people involved in these films. I mean, they can make a career out of this now.
They can do very well. In the old days, it was you would have your Batman guys, you know, your Burt Wards, and you'd have your Shatners from shows that were from years ago. Now it's a real blend. You'd have Elvira in the green room and Stan Lee's sleeping over in the corner, and Norman Reedus from current shows from Walking Dead. You'll have him and Johnny Bernthal, guys like that now from actual shows that are on the air. That's the main difference now, is now they have a blend of the old and the new.
So you write a little bit about this, but it must be so much fun to get to interact with this bizarre cross-section of people.
I geek out as much as anybody else, but, yeah. You know, you play it a little cool and have an angle. That's what I tell anybody who's meeting someone that you think, you know and love. Come up with an angle. I see people wait in line for 2 hours and they come up and they will not say a single word. My joke is they leave the tables like, let's talk again sometime. Because I got to sign your thing, but I'm happy to answer anything at the table or whatever. So I met Shatner, and I'm like, I'm not going Star Trek. I'm not, no way. I'm hitting
Too
him
many
with
people
one
do
out
that.
Of the blue.
That's done.
I'm going to hit him with what nobody else would. So I went T.J. Hooker, which is like, why would you pick T.J. Hooker? It's like, exactly. But I sort of studied T.J. Hooker, because at the time we were roughly the same age. Like, Shatner was in his mid-50s when I was watching him. Like, what was Shatner up to when he was in his mid-50s? And it was just funny to watch that show, and they would do these, what I call Shatner power slides, up to the crime scene. And they would hold, and Shatner would actually get out. So it was Shatner who did it.
He was driving the
car.
There's
no cutting. And so that's right. What I said to him. I said, Mr. Shatner, just wanted you know, I thought your power slides were pretty cool in that show. And his eyes just lit up, and I knew I had him. Because he told me the story of how the producers didn't want him to do that. He hooked up with the stunt guys. They figured out how to do it.
And he told you how he did it,
oh,
right?
It's a four-part maneuver. It's foot off the gas, emergency brake. The stunt guys would feather it so it wouldn't stick. He could feather it. And then you steer, because ironically, you can still steer with the emergency brake on. And then when you really want to stop, bam, you hit the brake. Only then, and you stop dead. It's amazing. So I had to do essentially that in the pilot for Ash versus Evil Dead, and I just heard it from Shatner. I'm like, wait a second. I think I know how to do this. And so I said to the stunt guys, is it this and that? And then they go, oh, yeah, that's it. So I did the Shatner power slide in front of this cheesy bar, and I hadn't seen Bill for a while. So then I finally saw him in the green room. I'm like, I got a Saturn Award last year for playing Ash, and Bill was there too, and I dedicated it to him and the Shatner power slide.
Because, nice.
You know, so if you meet somebody, try to come up with something, and not the obvious. Not the, like, hit me with like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs or something, or Love Bug. Don't go right for Evil Dead.
You've got a lot of people working really hard until they meet you tonight. Come up with something.
Yeah,
right.
We'll see.
So let's talk about going back to playing Ash, which that had to be the furthest thing from your mind.
It was pretty far.
Yeah. So how did it come about?
The Savages would never stay silent. I really give them a lot of credit, because I get this at conventions. When is Evil Dead 4? When is Evil Dead 4? People seem to forget Army of Darkness was a bomb. It went way over budget. It bombed. It cost 13, and it made 13. And that's pretty bad math in Hollywood terms. So it was dead.
Although it feels like it was a hit because everybody says that they saw it.
Now they say that. Sure, because there's 48 different DVDs out there of it. That's fine, but it was dead. As dead as dead can be. And then really this 90s DVD repackaging, back, you know, behind the scenes interviews, the making of, deleted scenes, storyboards. This company called Anchor Bay, interestingly, a Michigan company, they sublicensed all the Evil Dead movies and repackaged them. And I think it really got people kind of, oh, I remember those movies. It really helped the resurgence. And then the pressure was still on. When are you going to make another one? So we did a remake. We're like, well, wait a second. All right. Let's give you something. Give you a little taste. And it made money. And
everybody's doing remakes.
So we thought, well, why can't we? So it was the fans thought, okay, it was all right.
But they missed you.
No, they wanted Ash and they wanted Sam.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've learned after all this time, just you can't fight City Hall. Just shut up and do it. So we didn't want to make it as a movie. Rob Tappert was smart enough. He had just finished producing Spartacus for Starz. I had just finished Burn Notice. We were in a TV mentality. We knew how that could work. So we sold Sam on, let's not make a big, expensive Evil Dead movie. Let's pitch it as a show. Let's bring Ash back as a, you know, over-the-hill geezer who is so unqualified to save the world, and now let's make him save the world. and so the premise, I really enjoyed the premise because last time I had played Ash was 25 years before in Army of Darkness. It's been a long time, and I've actually learned some tricks of, like, how to act, you know, how to act better, be a better – I feel like George Lucas. I can go back and fix Ash. Now, I round him out, make him, like, a real character.
Except you did, and maybe George Lucas didn't, but
– I don't know. But anyway, that's what was intriguing to us. Starz was the best suitor because they were the only ones who had no content restrictions. And any hardcore Evil Dead fan have got to realize, if this came out as a feature film, it would be R-rated, not unrated. Because two out of the three Evil Dead movies have no rating. So when they went to rate Army of Darkness, the ratings board was so, they were so mean to us, it was unbelievable. They gave us an NC-17. And anyone who watches Army of Darkness, a 12-year-old could watch that movie. There's talking skeletons. You cut their head off, the dust comes out. We're like, what do you want from us? You know? And so Starz gave us that ability to just do it, which means you got to self-regulate. And so actors are always terrible. If they know they can swear, that's all they want to do. So you have to go, no. So we've had conversations. Who swears? Like Ash should do old-fashioned swearing. Kelly should just a foul mouth. Ray, who plays Pablo, when he's scared, he'll swear reactionary swearing. So we actually had to work that out because there was no restriction. Same with the Carnage and Mayhem. Where do you go? And where do you stop? You know, so we've had to pull back a little bit too. Last season, we got much more into the mythology of Ash because he's not just a loser in a trailer park. There's a picture of him in an ancient book. So we're getting a little more of the Joseph Campbell thing now because it is true. Why him? Why is he chosen to test the mettle of man? He's it. It's like we're so doomed.
So you're still having fun?
As much as you can for a TV show where you're in dark cellars covered with blood all the time. My wife, she finally coined it this year. I was sitting in my trailer all grumpy. She goes, you know what you have? You know what your problem is? Because she always hits it right on the head. She goes, you have poopy diaper syndrome. You have the equivalent of sitting around all day in a poopy diaper. And you have poopy
soggy
diaper
with
syndrome.
Pink yep. blood.
Yep.
Oh, Bruce Campbell, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
What a pleasure. Bruce Campbell, his latest memoir is Hail to the Chin, Further Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. He'll be at the Englert in Iowa City tonight in front of a sold-out crowd. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.